Welcome all of you to another Twitter Spaces, one with Spaces we call them. We hold them every day and we have topical issues. And this week our discussion is around FATF, Kenya's grey listing. Our guests are here today. I want them to introduce themselves. So we'll start with John and then Titus and then Katagaza will introduce ourselves. John, tell us a bit about yourself and what you do day to day.
Thanks, Mokai. And good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure being here. My name is John Kamau, very common names. I work with PwC and I've been with PwC for quite a while, about 16 years now. An associate director in the forensics team. So in the forensics team, our work revolves around fraud and financial crime, one of which is money laundering, terror financing, and lately proliferation financing topics I'm sure we'll be speaking about. We do work across the region, the South African region, and that's what I've been doing. Other than that, my background was engineering, then I took a detour into accounting and audit, and I've been doing that. Other than that, I'm a farmer, father, husband, and all those other things. And it's a pleasure being here. Thank you for the invite.
Thank you, John. Maybe you can tell us a bit about what sparked your interest in the area of financial crime before you go chat us.
Yes, to be honest, it's some of those things that find you as opposed to you finding them. When I was in campus in fifth year, PwC back then used to do these visits to the various universities. I was in Moi University, so they came, did a presentation. It was interesting. I applied to join the advisory line of service because I thought, since I didn't have any background in accounting or audit, advisory sounded like something someone could do. And during my interviews, that's when the partner that interviewed me asked me if I would be interested in joining the team. I did. I saw and described what it is that the team does. I found it interesting. And ever since, it has been interesting. So never regretted that opportunity.
Thank you, Joel. Our next speaker is Titus Kariuki. Maybe Titus, you can introduce yourself and then tell us a bit about your interest in financial crime.
Sure, Mokaya. And good evening, all. My name is Titus Kariuki. I'm a senior manager at PwC, specifically in the financial crimes business unit, which I happen to lead. My profile is not very different from that of John. John spoke about being at PwC for 16 years. I've been there 14 years. We pretty much do more or less the same thing, only that after many years of doing forensics work, I specialized more in financial crimes. And it was primarily because as a practice back in the day, we used to do a lot of investigative work, but there was always a question of how the people who involve themselves in fraud and other predicate offenses, as we call them, launder and benefit from those funds that on those particular resources. So it became a natural progression from investigations to now moving more towards understanding how the people, after they commit crimes, they move their funds and they ultimately benefit from them. So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. We mainly support organizations, both in the public and the private sector, to become better at combating financial crimes. And we do that in many ways through trainings to their boards and management and staff, through supporting them conduct risk assessments to understand the risk that they face, review of the AML, CFT, and CPF programs, among other wide range of services that we offer under financial crimes. That's me.
Thank you so much. Katangaza, maybe you could introduce yourself now.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Good afternoon to everybody. My name is Nankunda Katangaza, but I always find that Kenyans prefer to call me Katangaza because I think it has a very specific meaning and really so they like that, even though it doesn't mean the same thing in my mother's. I'm actually Ugandan. I'm the director and the co-founder of a specialist advisory firm called Hook Tangaza. My business partner is Hook, so hence the Tangaza coming together. We work based in the UK, and we are an advisory firm providing consultancy services to companies and in the legal services sector globally. So our expertise in relation to this particular topic is on regulatory reform. Previously was the head of international at the Law Society of England and Wales. So my work is in the legal services sector. We're currently doing a project in Kenya with the Law Society of Kenya to build their regulatory capacity for AML-CFT. So my background is not AML-CFT, but regulation of legal services, which certainly here and in many other jurisdictions has in the last 10 or so years included AML-CFT and supervising the profession on those topics. I was actually in Nairobi on Friday when the FATF announcement was made and had spent a week already with various law firms and the regulator on this issue. So it's quite fresh and I'm very pleased to be joining you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Agnes. I can see she's there in the audience. She's the one who recommended you to us. So maybe yes. We can start with you. You can tell us a bit about FATF and some of these acronyms that you're going to be using very commonly today. What's FATF and AML and and the word CFT.
Other speakers are far more experts at that, but luckily I actually do know what those three acronyms stand for. FATF is the Financial Action Task Force, which is a global body that countries are member states and essentially sets up the framework, the legal and regulatory framework for preventing money laundering and countering the financing of terrorism, and AML is anti-money laundering. I'll let your other colleagues speak on the detail of that, because mine's very empty in the hole. Thank you.
All right. John, Titus, maybe you can give us a bit more detail there, a little bit more flesh on those tags and what they mean practically.
Okay, I can go for it. I think Katangaza has covered it well, but I can give some more context. So FATF, as she has mentioned, is a financial action task force. And what FATF does, it's an international intergovernmental body. They do set standards around money laundering, terror financing, and more recently, proliferation financing. And what then is expected is that the countries affiliated to FATF are required to implement those particular standards in their jurisdictions. And the way FATF works, it's with regional bodies. They are called FATF-style bodies, regional FATF-style bodies. In the East Africa region and South Market area, we have such a body. It's called the Eastern and Southern Africa Anti-Money Laundering Group. And Kenya is a member of that particular group. And actually, Kenya currently occupies a leadership position within that particular group from last year. So we are steering basically that group. Now, money laundering, again, as we all know, it's a legal process of concealing proceeds of crime to make them appear legitimate. After people have committed crimes which generate illicit proceeds, what they tend to do is to seek to benefit from those funds, but to distance themselves from the funds, from the underlying crime that generated the funds. Then they go through what is called now the money laundering process, which typical language, like wash a pesa, as we call it, or wash. Terrorism financing, on the other side, is a provision of direct or indirect financial or other form of support with the knowledge that both funds or the financial support is going towards terrorism activities. It's very similar to proliferation financing, only that proliferation financing is more targeted towards development and deployment of weapons of mass destruction. It might appear or sound alien to us in Kenya, but actually it's a very real phenomenon. And as we speak down the line, it's one of the areas where FATF has called out Kenya in terms of not being enough to understand that particular risk and to be able and not having in place adequate measures and safeguards to ensure that the country is not being abused for that and we are not introducing unnecessary risk to the global financial system. I hope that helps Kaya in terms of adding some more meat to the comments made by Katangaza earlier.
Yes, it does. Maybe John, you can add there and maybe also tell us a bit about what grey listing means in connection to FATF.
Maybe to add is to give a bit of history in terms of how FATF came into being and the whole concept of AML, CFT, CPF, because then I guess it will help us understand the whole grey listing concept. So money laundering has been there for many years, or as long as the modern economy has been there. But in 1970, that's when we had the very first AML law, which was in the U.S. Bank Secrecy Act of 1970, which then required banks in the U.S. to report suspicious transactions. And ever since, the U.S. has pretty much played a key role in moving the whole AML-CFT conversation. So the efforts became a bit more international. 1988, there was what was called a Vienna Convention. Initially, it was meant mainly to enforce or encourage laws against narcotics. But come 1989, it expanded a bit more and the G7 group of nations then formed FATF. And they formed FATF to be a transgovernmental organization that will then help push the standards that they were already applying in those developed Western nations to the rest of the world so that money laundering then becomes harder because it has a very big sort of international elements. So for a long time, then the focus was on money laundering alone until the September 11 attacks in the US. And then there was the Patriot Act. And then from then on, terror financing then became just as important as money laundering. And more recently, as Titus has mentioned, they've then been pushed also towards fighting proliferation financing. So FATF has always been a body that seeks to get pretty much everybody else in the world to meet certain standards and recommendations. So there's the famous 40 recommendation that FATF has made that comments how jurisdiction organizations, especially financial organizations, but organizations generally should behave, what sort of laws they should have. So for instance, there'll be a requirement that you should have an anti-money laundering law. Like in Kenya, we have what is called POKAMLA. that was passed way back in 2009 and came really into force around 2010, 2011 after Kenya had been greylisted again. So how PATIV has managed to pretty much get countries to comply is by shimming, which is what you'd call the greylisting. The names have changed over time. But currently we have two lists, the gray list and the black list. Maybe let me start with the black list because it's easier to describe. The only big countries in that black list, North Korea, Iran, and Myanmar. And pretty much if you're in the black list, FATIV advises countries to take action against you, your high-risk jurisdiction, and there'll be sanctions pretty much. And then you have those countries which are said to be in the gray list, where there are countries where FATIV, the countries themselves acknowledge the recommendations of PATIV, the standards that PATIV has set. They've already put in place measures, programs, laws that are consistent with the recommendations of PATIV, but there are certain strategic deficiencies. So you evaluated and you are found to have strategic deficiencies, but you have shown commitment to deal with those deficiencies, then you're put on the gray list, which is what has happened to Kenya now for the second time. First time was in 2011 to 2014. During that period, that's when POKAMLA, the law, came into force. That's around the time FRC, the Financial Reporting Center, was established, and quite a number of things happened after Kenya was put on the gray list. And that has been pretty much what has happened across the world. Countries are put into the gray list, and because of that focus, and I'm sure we will go into detail in terms of what the effects are, countries then tend to do what they probably weren't doing or do it faster in terms of then complying with the recommendations of PATIV. So the gray list is almost like a list of shame, but one that acknowledges that the country is in the right path and acknowledges the gaps and is working towards the gaps. And therefore, it's taken a matter of time before they get out of the gray list. So that's the gray list. And pretty much what it does, it made the rest of the bit nervous in dealing with you. But I'm sure we'll get into that. Hope that helps.
John, how long can one stay on this gray list? And then how quickly can you get out of this gray list? And how long can you be inside the gray list? What's the shortest or longest period you can stay? How often are the reviews?
They are what are called mutual evaluations. So Taita spoke of the Eastern and Southern Africa Anti-Money Laundering Group, which is a group of 21 countries and is what, as has mentioned, is a FATF style regional body. It's pretty much like the regional arm of FATF, only that it's an independent organization that is formed by those member countries. So what happens is every so often, maybe every 10 years or so, there's a mutual evaluation. So there was one done on Kenya in 2011, 2010, I think, that then resulted in Kenya being placed on the gray list in 2011. And within 3 years, Kenya had put in place the required measures. And pretty much back then, we didn't have the laws. So it was the basics. It was you set up the laws. So we set up POKAMLA, the regulations for POKAMLA. There was then POTA, the law on terrorism. So all of these Prevention of Terrorism Act in 2012. So many of these acts, at that point, Kenya did not actually have the laws. It did not have the institutions, the likes of FRC, which is the sort of supervisor or regulator, if you may. And because then those were the deficiencies that had been identified, once we were able to deal with them and show that we've made progress, we were removed from the list. They took about 3 years. Other countries have been, I think the one that comes to mind is a country like Syria. It's been on the list for many years, I think from 2010 or thereabouts. But there are some, like Mauritius, I think, caught onto the list and was out of that list within a year or so. So it's a question of how quickly you deal with the issues that are evaluated during the mutual evaluation. So the second mutual evaluation for Kenya happened in 2022. So the report was issued in September of 2022. And it's the report that has then led to us being greylisted because the report highlighted various gaps in terms of not so much the laws, but how effectively we implement those laws and how effective the programs, the AML, CFT programs we have are. So it highlighted certain deficiencies, some of which were also gaps in law. And as soon as that report was out in September 2022, the government started taking action immediately. So you have, for instance, the amendments that were passed on POKAMLA last year. So they sought to deal with quite a number of the deficiencies that had been noted. The likes of CBK, Central Bank of Kenya, CMA, they've been doing evaluations, reviews to check the sectors that they regulate. with a view to plugging those gaps that have been highlighted. So the government and the other institutions are working, I guess, as hard as possible, I would imagine, to try and get the country out of the list as quickly as possible. But it all depends on how quickly we are able to plug the gaps.
In 15 minutes, we've covered quite a bit. We'll come back to you, John and Titus, to tell us a bit more. So maybe, Katangaza, you can tell us a bit about the mood when you heard about the FATF Kenya's grey listing and what kind of implications you'd expect from that while you were in Nairobi and from your experience so far.
The mood was a little bit muted, mainly because I think there was a view that was going to happen. It was expected and it would have probably been a different feeling, obviously. Kenya hadn't been grey listed and a surprised one. So I would say that was expected. On the legal sector side, which I will say a little bit about because that's actually the one that I'm mostly involved in, John gave an overview of the mutual evaluation process and the report that came out, I think it was 21. The legal sector was highlighted in there as a sector of high concern. And that makes sense because lawyers facilitate all business transactions and personal ones as well, obviously. So they're a very key sector in terms of potentially enabling or prohibiting and the flow of illicit funds. The Law Society, which is the professional body, was very reluctant for the members to be required to report suspicious transactions, which is what everybody else is doing and what the banks have in place and many other regulators had already set themselves up to make sure that the professions that they regulated were doing this. But the lawyers were extremely resistant. I just have to say quickly, this is not a unique Kenyan position. All lawyers are always resistant to anything, particularly where the word change is involved. And they pushed back quite strongly and said this would be a violation of client confidentiality, etc. And I believe that this grey listing was perhaps, to no sort of small extent, a result of that, the fact that the lawyers were outside of the regulatory regime of FAT, the Financial Reporting Center, which is a supervisory body. The lawyers went to court to make sure that they were not going to be reporting to anyone, but certainly not to the FRC. And a compromise was reached towards the end of last year where they were allowed to report to their professional body. Now, this is highly unusual because everybody else is reporting to the FRC. And when I say reports, suspicious transactions or any sort of, you're asked to do something that you're a bit suspicious might be an activity that's laundering money or that's going to be used for financing terrorism, you must report the FRC. So that function has now been, the compromise was that the Law Society of Kenya would take on that responsibility of receiving suspicious reports from its members. That's unusual. As I said, even in most jurisdictions, everybody reports directly to whoever the agency is. In the UK, it's the National Crime Agency. Our lawyers, any solicitors, barristers, etc., would report to the National Crime Agency directly and not to their professional body. So the professional body, which has not really had much in the way of regulatory function, now has to start off its regulatory journey with something as significant as this. So it's not small things that would have built up its capacity over the years. They seem to be alert to the fact that this is going to have to change and it's not a government attempt to conflict them in some way or to take away their independence, but it's a very long journey. John mentioned the technical changes that need to happen in order for jurisdiction to leave the grey list, and many of those have happened already in Kenya. The laws have been changed. I think on paper, a lot is already done, but the implementation is where the magic is. And if certainly on the legal side, if the lawyers have not implemented this new regulatory function and that it's working and the people will report, that's going to be something that potentially delays the process of leaving the grey list. Obviously, that means that particular sector will be highly exposed to scrutiny and etc., which will be uncomfortable and which will hopefully make some movement happen. I have to say that this is not at all something that all lawyers in Kenya want to avoid. Many are really keen to actually be compliant and they want the guidance, which is what the professional body's role would normally be, to provide guidance, carry out risk assessments in the sector, carry out risk, help the law firms, etc., carry out their own risk assessments, etc. So it's going to be a little bit of a longer journey for that particular profession. Others have already connected with the FRC and people are reporting directly, whether they're accountants or casinos or other professions that were seen to be risky. So I think for that particular sector, that's going to be something that will need to move fast. But I suspect that there are others where implementation might have started that hasn't necessarily moved as quickly as it needs to. So that was something that will be very much watched over the coming months.
Thank you. So just moving on to Titus and John, you can give us a bit, I think Katangaza had started it, like in terms of implications for Kenya as a country and for some of the countries, drawing also from the experience of other countries that have been on the grey list, what are the things that you can expect from being on the gray list, status you can start? And then secondly, what are some of the key things that Kenya has been missing that made them be placed on the gray list specifically? So let's tackle those two for now. Titus and then John.
Perhaps a good starting point is where John left it on what a gray listing really is. It's an international sort of shame list where as a country, you are called out for having certain deficiencies in your AML CFT regime. For the soccer fans, probably you will liken it to a yellow card where FATF is not necessarily calling for other countries to apply countermeasures on you, but they're just pointing out that you have certain deficiencies in your AML CFT program. But you've made a commitment as a country to address those particularly deficiencies. So even though FATF does not call for any countermeasures, unfortunately, the grey listing will inevitably have an impact on a country. And this has been seen elsewhere from countries which have been grey listed, and also institutions, the likes of IMF, have done some studies around that. And the conclusion has been that indeed there is an adverse impact on a country once you're placed on the grey list like Kenya was the other day. Now, in terms of the more practical implications of grey listing, I think the more immediate one and one that as a country we will face in the near future is increased scrutiny on financial transactions, especially international financial transactions. Now, because as a country, obviously, we pride and position ourselves as a regional hub and we do trade with many other countries globally, and our banks and through other means, we do business with other countries. Now, once you are put on the grey list, then everybody has to look at you cautiously. Financial transactions originating from your country or terminating in your country are inevitably subjected to more scrutiny because you're already perceived to be high risk. Now, if you look at financial institutions, for instance, they work a lot with banks domiciled in the other countries, especially in the West, called correspondent banks would be supporting them in clearing foreign currencies, your dollars, your pounds. Now, those particular institutions, they do apply due diligence on banks in Kenya that they work with, for instance. But now once you are put on the grey list, then that level of scrutiny is escalated further and the level of due diligence you're subjected to becomes even more. So we do expect going forward from a banking perspective, from an international transactions point of view, we will be subjected to quite a lot of scrutiny. And that comes with other implications like cost of transactions escalating, obviously, because people are spending more time looking at their transactions in more detail to understand or to give themselves comfort that they are not proceeds of crime. That process is a costly process, and that cost is then pushed down to the consumers, if you like. Now, the other point would be around things like foreign direct investment. And as I mentioned earlier, there are studies that have been done by the likes of IMF, which have showed that once a country is greenlisted, it does impact the foreign direct investment. And all that stems from the perceived risk. When investors are looking where to invest, obviously no one wants to go to a place where there is association with the risk of money laundering, terror finance, or international finance. And they're given options between a country that is not grey listed and presenting the same opportunity. You would see why someone would opt to take a risk-based approach and prefer to go where the risk is lower. So we do expect from an FDI point of view, foreign direct investment, that the country is likely to suffer, maybe not in the immediate short term, perhaps in the medium to short term, depending on how we navigate out of the grey list and how quickly we get out of the grey list. International trade, again, that's a point I've mentioned, that is likely to also be impacted. Here in the country, we have many of our businesses sourcing for products and supplies from other countries doing business, and that would be large businesses and also SMEs. It's also expected now for the exporters and the importers, they'll also be impacted in a way from a transaction point of view. The cost of transactions being required to provide more information around the transactions you're undertaking, because whoever you are doing business with wants to assure themselves that whatever business that they're doing with you is legit business. There is another point around the concept of de-risking, and I touched on it briefly, but I could spend a bit more time on it. Over time, there are other studies which have shown that once as a country, you are greenlisted. The correspondent banks that I spoke to earlier, some of them take the easier way, so to speak, and instead of exposing themselves to the risk of doing business with you and probably in the process processing illicit funds, some of them tend to terminate their relationship, and that concept is called de-risking. This has happened to a number of countries in Africa, especially where we've seen a large multinational bank terminating relationships with particular countries due to that perceived risk. So that is something that could potentially happening in our country. We can only wait to see how that plays out, but it's a likely implication. If you think about things like currency, the value of the Kenya shillings, for instance, over recent months, the currency has depreciated quite significantly, although it has been gaining in the last few weeks. Now, being put on the gray list obviously has a negative connotation, and is likely to impact the currency as well, because it's a dent in the confidence people have in the local currency. So that is likely to create some currency depreciation and eventually inflationary sort of pressures. So there is quite a lot there that happened. It's not always that everything that I've spoken about will come to be. We are just highlighting the most potential risk that could befall Kenya because of being put on the gray list. Now, your second question, Mukaya, remind me, it was about why Kenya was put on the gray list, is that correct?
Yes, and what are the kind of steps that you can take to get out of that? Maybe I can give to John. You can grab a glass of water in the meantime. John, now, you can tell us what are some of the issues that Kenya needs to address and how can they be addressed in terms of getting out of the gray list?
I would categorize them into two. There are issues to do with compliance, which is more Kenya put in place the right laws, and the issues to do with effectiveness. So you might have laws, but in terms of the effectiveness of your implementing these laws or supervision, are they effective? And as I go into them, I think that will be the other effect that we expect will be had, will come out of this gray listing. And people have already started feeling it ever since the mutual evaluation report came out, because one of the issues that was highlighted was that whereas, for instance, microfinance banks have in place sort of good and sound EML, CFT programs and measures, it is not the case with some of the other reporting institutions. So from an EML perspective, you have institutions that are designated as reporting institutions. Designated means that you have a legal obligation to report suspicious transactions to FRC. So banks, for instance, insurance companies, they've been doing that for a while. They've invested in systems. They've employed money laundering reporting officers. They have very good policies. But then you have what are called the designated non-financial businesses and professionals. So that's, for instance, where the lawyers fall. So one of the findings was that these non-financial institutions, in terms of the programs they have in place, they are not mature. They've not really invested in them. They don't understand the risks that they face. Their supervisors are not supervising them properly. So then one of the expectations is that if it's the LSK, for instance, if LSK turns out to be the supervisor of law firms, then LSK needs to be seen to be supervising law firms properly. ISPAC for accountants, and you have other designated bodies, one of which was also highlighted as high risk and not much has been done, is the real estate industry, for instance. Because a lot of money laundering in Kenya happened through real estate, through lawyer, and that was identified by the country even before the mutual evaluation. Kenya as a country did what is called a national risk assessment about a year before the mutual evaluation. And they highlighted things like real estate and lawyer as high risk. So one of the issues was, if these are high risk professions or businesses, how come they are not reporting suspicious transactions to the FRC? So banks are reporting, insurance companies are reporting, but we don't see lawyers, we don't see real estate, we don't see the Ministry of Mining that's supposed to regulate precious metals reporting. So failure in supervision was one of those failures. There are certain gaps in law, most of which were addressed by the amendments to the POCAMLA that happened last year. But you still have deficiencies in things like ultimate beneficial owners. So one of the key cornerstones of EML is KYC, knowing your customer. Because it's only after you know who your customer is that you get to know that this customer is related to the governor of a certain county or some other politically exposed person or some known gold dealer. And then you can apply enhanced due diligence on such a person or entity. So one of the major gaps in Kenya is that it's only recently that we established a UBO register, ultimate beneficial owner register, so that if you have a company, the shareholders might not be the ultimate beneficial owners, the people who actually benefit from that company. So that's one of the other gaps that we then need to look at. Another gap that was highlighted and resulted in our being relisted is the lack of prosecution and conviction on money laundering or terror financing. Actually, ever since POCAMLA was passed, I don't believe there's been a single conviction for money laundering. For instance, you have a case of corruption. So corruption becomes the predicate offense. Or if you con someone and you tell them you're selling them gold, but you're selling them painted dust, then that crime becomes the predicate offense. Predicate meaning it's the offense that gives rise to the illicit funds. So Kenya has been investigating those predicate offenses, and even there, there's still scope to do more and better, both in terms of investigation and prosecution and convictions. But at least something has been happening. And as a country, we are able to say we have recovered these proceeds of corruption. We have these people that were prosecuted or convicted for fraud or forgery. But then there's a question of why are there not any convictions for money laundering? If you are a governor, for instance, and you go and you steal money from a county, and then you take that money and give it to a lawyer, and the lawyer puts that money in a client account, and then you use that client account, for instance, to import vehicles that are then put in a yard somewhere in Nairobi, and then you sell those vehicles and you use those proceeds to build an apartment block in Kilimani, and then you go and open a bank account where you are banking the proceeds from that apartment, and you can then pass your wealth as coming from investments in apartments, you would have done money laundering through its, there are three processes for money laundering. Placement, which is when you initially put the money into the system, at the point at which, for instance, you give the lawyer the money and they opened a client account for you. Then what is called layering, in terms of doing many other transactions so that the original source of the money is not so clear, which is what you'd be doing when you're importing the cars, selling them, paying a contractor to build an apartment. And then there's finally integration, when you now go back to the financial system as a legitimate business. So if you are a governor or any other politician or any other person for that matter, and you are guilty of that initial crime of corruption, all these other people that facilitated you in laundering the money, the lawyers, the kaya, the real estate agents, they should all be prosecuted for money laundering. So that has not happened in Kenya. Same case with terrorism. So we have people been prosecuted and convicted for terrorism, but no one has been convicted for terror financing, which was the other thing that was highlighted in terms of, as a country, we don't quite understand our terror financing risks in terms of how terrorism financing presents itself, which then means even all those people who are supposed to be reporting suspicious transactions, if you don't know what you're looking for, then there's nothing you're looking for. So that was another issue around, we need to understand better how terrorism financing appears, look like, so that we can say we are dealing with it. Another area that was highlighted is NPOs and NGOs or not-for-profit organizations, and especially in terms of how they can be used for terror financing, but generally around their supervision. So NGOs or NPOs are registered in very many different regimes. So not all of them, for instance, will be registered by the NGO board. But the NGO board is supposed to be supervising NGOs from an AML, CFT perspective. And given you have some of these NGOs operating in very high risk areas, especially in terms of terror, there was felt that there's not enough that we are doing as a country in terms of just understanding the risk that comes from POs. Another area was around the flows from the neighboring countries. Kenya is a commercial hub for Eastern Africa, but not many cases of suspicious transactions are reported. And there's therefore the question, if we have DRC next to us with all the coal that is moving from there, we have Somalia, South Sudan, how is it that this has, we don't have any suspicious transactions being reported coming out of these inflows? So pretty much what Patty was saying, the laws are by and large there, but from an effectiveness perspective, if we are not seeing the convictions, if we are not seeing those suspicious transactions being reported, then the system is not really working. So whereas in 2011, it is that we didn't have the laws, for 2022, we have the laws, but is our entire AML, CFT, CPF framework actually effective? The last thing I'll probably say is proliferation financing. I think before the mutual valuation, not many people in Kenya had ever heard of it, including the financial institutions that you'd expect to be monitoring for it. So that was also an obvious gap, because if we are supposed to be monitoring for proliferation financing, and nobody is, and that's a failure. So in a nutshell, those are the areas that led to us being relisted, and therefore the areas that we need to address for us to get out of the grey list.
That's a comprehensive check. Let me ask, is Titus, has anything to add before I go to Nankunda? Titus?
Yes, Mokaya. Perhaps one area that also fit prominently in the mutual evaluation was more around the virtual assets. We've all heard about emergence of cryptocurrencies and Kenya leading many countries in terms of embracing that whole phenomenon, and Kenya is actively involved in the trading of cryptocurrencies. Now, that space is quite high risk from a money laundering point of view. During the mutual evaluation, and remains the case up to now, see, it's not an area that as a country we have paid a lot of attention to by way of regulations and enforcement. So it's one of the areas where then as a country, we were, according to evaluators, we need to do something about, and we cannot continue burying our heads in the sand forever. We need to understand and appreciate that virtual currencies are here with us. Kenyans are actively involved in them. They are trading in them on a day-to-day basis. They present a very big money laundering risk because they come with an element of anonymity, which people seeking to launder money or for terrorism financing find quite attractive. We need to do more in that space by law of regulations and actually enforcing and ensuring that what is happening in that space is being monitored and it's not money laundering, terror financing and other predicate offenses are not happening within that space.
Anything you can add in that regard, but also you can tell us a bit about some of the deficiencies that you've noted in Kenya, and especially when you look at those vis-a-vis international best practices in some of the other countries that you've also been observing. Maybe you can tell us that and some of the practical implications to grey listing that you may have noticed also.
I think that my co-speakers have really covered the detail of this, and thank you very much. I've learned a lot just even listening to you. I think my home country, as I mentioned before, is Uganda, which the same time as Kenya went on the grey list, got off the grey list. That was a pleasant surprise. And I say surprise because of the issues around implementation, effective implementation versus having all the paperwork and having all the laws changed, etc. But clearly they did something right, which meant that they got off the grey list and they were on for about 5 years, I believe. So at least one East African original member state is not, it's not all three of them that are on the grey list now. So it was a bit of a swap on that front. Like I said before, my thing is really on the legal sector, which is important. The comparators had made a small jurisdiction, which is Cayman Islands, which was on the grey list for a number of years as well and had a complete absence of regulation for legal. And that was when it fell down. And this was about 2018-ish, I believe, 2017. And they only recently got off the grey list, but it did require a significant amount of work on their part. Now, the Cayman Island is essentially a treasure island, so it's not a diverse huge economy, like a variety of differences of income investment. It essentially really has one based on income. So it was critical for them to get off the grey list because they manage everyone's money and put it in different accounts. It's one where you could see very quickly that the diversion of funds of money to activities that are not in keeping with the rules, it was very much a danger for them. But when I compare that to when they put their regulatory framework in place and got off the grey list, that made a huge difference to the whole country because that was the economy relied on that. When I look at other places, I think Bulgaria was grey listed recently. Nigeria, which is the biggest economy on the continent, is on the grey list. They were grey listed at the end of last year. It'll be very interesting to watch their process and how they get on in their next initial evaluation. But the impact, somebody said earlier, is that the whole economy just feels the little ripples of, especially in the financial services sector, or caution, if you like. What I'm concerned about, again, back to the sector of most interest to me, is that the institution that was now entrusted with taking the reports from lawyers doesn't have the capacity, and it will take a while to build up that capacity. They are a critical institution, and the compromise, which was for the MSK to take on to receive the reports, may prove to be a little bit difficult. In the short term, certainly it will. Here in the UK, interestingly enough, it's been about 20 years since they introduced the AML TFT rules came in and applied to the legal sector. And there was resistance as well. It's not unusual. There was resistance, but it actually led to a much better, ultimately functioning regulatory system for the profession. And now, actually, anecdotally, I heard recently that the National Crime Agency is inundated with suspicious reports from lawyers. They're actually a bit concerned that lawyers are so acute and risk averse that they're just sending everything over, then reporting everything. So I suppose that's a good problem to have. But it does take time for these things to bed in. And it does take time when people consider their bread and butter as they see it under the extension. Not only violating what they believe is a confidential arrangement with their clients, but also a privileged conversational relationship with their client, but also that they're turning work away, which is something that has come up a lot in our conversations in Kenya. Turning work away is not something you do. You don't judge your clients. You simply do follow their instructions. But it will take a while for people to realize that actually these instructions that you may take from a client because you don't want to question where their money came from or what they're doing can and probably did ultimately lead to the acts of terrorism that we saw in Nairobi a few years ago. Somebody facilitated someone who bought whatever they bought and managed to do what they did. I think people need to see that closer to home and understand that process and their potential role in it. That would make a huge difference. I think that's all I have to say on that point.
Maybe sometimes people don't want to lose a client in terms of asking more questions, and then the client will go to the next door to take their business there. How do you advise then the legal profession in terms of handling these and other issues that come up when you have to report financial crimes?
I think that what you're trying to do is create a noose, for lack of a better way of putting it. So if everyone says no, then eventually, and if everyone has the right processes, I'll give you an anecdote. There was a lawyer we were speaking to I was speaking to last week, and she described a situation 2 years ago of having a new client come in who was from a South American country. So she was quite surprised there are not many South Americans hanging around in Nairobi, but that's fine. So the South American came, said, and I'm not going to name the country because I don't want to sound like I'm stereotyping anyway, but said, we want to open up a business, set it up here in Nairobi. We've got significant amounts of money that we are investing in a precious metals business in the DRC. So she thought the combination of all these things was something that didn't sound quite right. But luckily, the firm had a KYC process in place. There were forms that the clients would have to fill in, new clients, onboarding, etc. Know your clients, which they gave to the clients. And he disappeared and never came back again. She was relieved that she didn't have to deal with that. Now, if it was happening now, she would probably have reported it. But her KYC processes keep her safe and she feels more comfortable with that. Now, sure enough, he may have gone somewhere else and may have even had his work done for him. But if everybody puts a ring around that and does not take that client, then that locks that money out of doing whatever it is that it was trying to do it. But also the other thing is it actually makes the firms themselves stronger. This is another argument. They're more attractive to international business, etc., because they have robust systems in place to prevent these things. And they also have some expertise in something that they can sell on, actually, as a practice area. They can have on the AML, CFT, their own clients and for the fellow law firms. I believe it creates another stream of work for firms that really take on all these new areas robustly. But one of the things that's worth mentioning, actually, in Kenya, that's as a result of the amendments that were made to the POCAN law, were to make it that buying and selling of real estate or the formation or corporation of companies and trusts will now be undertaken exclusively by advocates, which was not the case before. So that's a whole new area of work that has now been guaranteed to lawyers only in order to ensure that they can undertake their AML obligations under POCAN law more effectively. So there's new areas of work opening up as a result of this. And it's actually a bright future than it may appear to be at this stage of the game.
This one, to reiterate something Katangaza said, which is a very key point. Actually, two. First is some of these things are not done simply for complying, for the sake of complying. They actually have very real life implications. For instance, like I just mentioned about NGOs and being used for terror financing. When the 1998 bombings happened, how the terrorists were able to move the bombs or the equipment, the materials they needed to make the bombs, was because they did that through an NGO. So then they were able to transport, to clear the items that they needed and transport them on the guise of, we are doing this for the sake of an NGO. So it's very real life. It actually has very real implications. The second is also, in as much as we are focusing on what are the effects of green listing to us as a country, probably the bigger focus should be what are the effects of money laundering or terror financing for that matter to us as a country. So if you think about, say, real estate prices in Nairobi and where they've gotten, it is said that a lot of that money or what drives some of the prices up is actually illicit funds. So if you allow as a country, if we make it easy for people to come and launder their money here, then it means anybody trying to do clean business is actually pushed out of business. So if we go to a place where no bank will take the money, no lawyer will open an account for a corrupt individual, then we'll deal with some of these economic crimes and as a country, then we will benefit. So we shouldn't view it as something that we do to get out of the greenest, but something that actually has very good, real advantages for us as a country. I thought I would just emphasize.
On that note, John, then how can private sector help in the government in terms of enhancing compliance with AML and CFT? And from your workings with organizations and people around, what are some of the things that you've noted that maybe businesses and individuals can do to enhance this?
So one is just actually investing in effective AML CFT measures. So banks, for instance, have done this, and we've done quite a number of trainings and reviews for banks, and have been in meetings where the CEO says we actually would rather have less business than engage in unethical business. And when you have that right tone from the top, then people start looking at AML CFT seriously. So that as opposed to looking at it as a compliance, as something that we do to tick the box, then as private institutions, because most of the reporting institutions are actually private institutions, whether you're talking of banks, whether you're talking of law firms, accountancy firms, insurance companies, most of them are in the private sector. So that's one thing that they can do as businesses. But also as citizens, one of the major sort of consequences of AML CFT is that it makes things a bit harder to do. So when you're opening a bank account, for instance, KYC requirements will be a bit more stringent, or when the telcos tell you to go and register your ID again to ensure that they have right details, or when the bank asks you to give a reason for why transferring more than $1 million, or you want to withdraw $1 million in cash. I think the citizenry should be a bit more understanding, so that, for instance, if a bank is asking you for these things, it is doing that for our benefit as a country, so that maybe we don't complain too much, so long as we understand. That's not to say that, for instance, those institutions should not invest in making the process as customer friendly as possible, and that's what we advise should happen. You should not give up your customer centricity so as to comply. You should do it in a way that helps you comply while still being efficient. The other thing we can do is to put pressure on especially our government, the parliament, for instance, in terms of passing some of these laws and keeping some of these things in the public discourse, in the limelight. So if it's, for instance, that conversation around lawyers resisting being reporting institutions, I think people should probably be a bit more invested in some of these conversations, because there are conversations that have been happening, but maybe haven't gotten as much attention. These are the ones that come to mind. I don't know, maybe Titus might have a few more.
Thanks, John, for that comprehensive coverage. I could add some more points, because I think particularly in us getting out of the grey list, there is quite a lot that needs to be done by both the public, that's the government, and also the private sector institutions. Borrowing from the Mauritius experience, when Mauritius was grey listed, and as John mentioned, they exited the grey list in a record time, I think it was about 18 months. One of the things that they did particularly very well was a public-private sector collaboration. That, I would say, in Kenya, we haven't done very well in that area in the past, although we've seen government efforts by the likes of FRC trying to engage the private sector a bit more, having dialogues frequently just to discuss some of these changes and challenges and how as a country we can deal with them. So if you look at the journey that we need to walk ahead of us, that bit around the how well the public and the private sector collaborate will be quite critical. Group forums like what I mentioned, regular dialogues and consultations to discuss some of these challenges and what the private sector is going through, what the government's thinking is, and how both of them can work towards getting us out of the grey list, but more importantly, managing the risk that we face of money laundering and peripheral financing. The other thing would be things like awareness programs, because again, that's quite critical when you come to AMCFT matters, and another opportunity for the government and the private sector to collaborate. I think there's a very big disconnect between what the public out there understands money laundering to be, or even this whole conversation about grey listing. It's something that we were discussing internally. Perhaps it's a phenomenon that is understood by very few. I think there is a scope for the government and the private sector to work together in terms of just raising more awareness here, educating the masses a bit more. And there is value ultimately in doing that, because then the public will also play their role in this AML CFT effort. It should not be seen as a government and institutions only driven initiative, but there is a big role for the public to play in there. If you think about things like culture, so for instance, if you educate people about what are the consequences of money laundering, what are the consequences of terror financing, then that inevitably will drive the right culture within the public. And people will see the need or the need to do some of these things, or how to protect themselves from being taken advantage of for money laundering and terror financing. Another bit that we've seen an opportunity for improvement as a country is around how we share information, particularly between the private and the public sector. That has not been done very well in the past, although we must give credit where it's due. The government, especially through the FRC, has been doing quite a lot in the recent past, creating automated channels to which financial institutions and other institutions are able to report suspicious transactions, for instance. But beyond the suspicious transactions reporting, I think there is much more information that needs to be exchanged between the private and the public sector, all in concerted efforts towards ensuring that the country is managing this risk appropriately. When we think about things like technical assistance, for instance, especially for the smaller organizations and businesses, for banks, as John was mentioning, they might have deeper pockets and they have done quite a lot over the years to have in place working AML CFT programs. But there's another whole crop of organizations, particularly NGOs, who might not have the financial muscle and they don't have that benefit of having invested in this over time. So the knowledge gap there is quite significant, and there's scope, for instance, for the government to do a bit more in those spaces to be able to support those type of organizations to get to the level where the banks and the insurance companies are. So the point there is around as a country, as we strategize on how to get out of the FATF crisis and how to better manage this particular risk, we need to think more broadly around how we can collaborate more between public, private, and also with the general population.
That's a detailed answer to the question. We can see a few requests to speak, but the problem is I think Twitter is having one of those hiccups it has, so it's really hard to add any new speakers. So for now, the way you can participate in the conversation is still just below the pinned tweet. You can write your question, you can DM us, and then you can be able to pick up your questions. So a couple of questions, maybe one that is for Katangaza specifically. Yes. Someone keeps asking here, and I think one of the most common questions when Kenyan grey listing came up was, why is Switzerland not on that grey list? It's a common question. Do you have any response to that, Katangaza?
I don't, actually. And funnily enough, I was speaking to somebody yesterday who was a head of financial crime in the firm that she works for. And her response to the UAE coming off the grey list was that she's not changing her advice at all internally, and they will continue to act as if our UAE is on the grey list. So I honestly couldn't tell you the answer to that. I'm assuming the little clear, transparent process that takes place when these things are decided. I don't know if Switzerland is a member of FATF. I assume it is. Because, and I was actually going to mention this at some point in this conversation, because I saw a lot of the coverage in Kenyan press and some social media was the suggestion that Africans are being picked on, or developing countries as a whole are being picked on. And I don't really agree with that, because actually, and you just have to look at the list and you know eventually not the case. So yeah, I don't know why Switzerland is not grey listed and why UAE is off the grey list. I think maybe Titus and John might be in a better position to answer that question.
John, Titus, also no, like a question that Katangaza has raised about Africans being targeted. So I think that's a very common question and response that you've seen on Twitter. I shared an experience of a friend who, when they went to open a bank account in Sweden, and then they mentioned Kenya in the business application for the account process, I think that mention alone made sure that they didn't get there to open the account. So I think then it's hard for an African to ask themselves, like, okay, why are you discriminating against us in a way? Or what's the problem with Kenya, so to speak here? So maybe John, invite us, you can speak to that in terms of risks inherent in some of these classifications.
No, I was actually happy when you directed the question to Katangaza. I was hoping she'll give the answer. I suppose the fact is, indeed, if you look at the list, Africa and developing countries seem to feature quite prominently, which on one, I think is not surprising, because if you think about it, the question that FATF asks itself is, A, do you understand your risks? Because one of, I think is the first recommendation of FATF, is that you should have a risk-based approach. So you should know what we call typologies. If it's a corruption, how does corruption happen? If it's trafficking, how does trafficking present itself? Do you have the data? So from that perspective, the more advanced or the richer countries, let me put it that way, have more resources to have a better understanding of their risks. So if you're Switzerland or you are Dubai, you probably can answer those questions. You can show how it is that you understand your risks. If it's a question of laws, in some of those countries will definitely be a bit more advanced. They have the resources to plug the gaps in laws, so the laws will be there. And countries like Switzerland, actually, the current Switzerland is very different from the Swiss banks that everybody knew of, where you could just go and no questions asked. That's actually not the case. So right now, if you want to open an account in Switzerland, for instance, there'll be serious KYC. They will know who you are. So I imagine that once they know who you are and they know what the risks are, then they are reporting these suspicions to, if you are suspicious, then that is the information that is then reported to their FRC equivalent. So what we call financial intelligence units. If you think about it, when FATF checks a country and checks whether you've ticked the boxes, the developed countries will be better placed to tick the boxes. So from that perspective, I would understand why. From the question of, despite all the things we hear about how stolen funds from Africa, for instance, end up in some of those jurisdictions, is one I don't have an answer to. The other thing I can say is, from a sanctions perspective, regulatory sanctions perspective, there are very serious fines in many of those countries for non-compliance or for entities that are found to be, for instance, dealing with people who are sanctioned. So the governments there, if asked, will be able to show, give cases of a number of banks that have been fined, licenses that have been withdrawn. They'll have the laws. So I would imagine it would be easier for them to answer the question, as opposed to a situation where you go to a country and there are no laws, the institutions are not there, then I suppose such a country would more easily end up in that list. However, probably some questions better be answered by Fatih, unless Titus, you have something to add.
No, John, it's a question that has been asked, not yet, even global, but it's one of those that still no answer. Can only put it as a question out there for Fatih to address.
There's a question here from Jack, and I think it's a very practical question because PayPal seems to be one of those that likes holding Kenyan funds and especially Africans' funds. He's asking, should he expect more of PayPal having this kind of holding back his resources as regards this gray listing?
Yeah, that's a potential risk, and not only to that institution, but generally across. As indicated earlier, once you're put on the gray list, naturally everybody starts at you very cautiously, and they would want to do a bit more by way of just to give themselves the assurance that the business that you are doing with them is legit business and you are not the business of money laundering, terror financing. The way financial institutions generally structure their processes, they are required to have a risk-based approach. They deal with customers in how they process transactions, and a risk-based approach means that they need to evaluate what the risk of doing business is with you and then define certain parameters which then they will be employing every time you're transacting. Now, one of the parameters that many institutions, even here locally, apply is that once you are put on the gray list, then that becomes a variable parameter that is included in the model and one that is considered when you're transacting or when you're being onboarded as a customer. So even for Kenyans opening bank accounts jurisdictions, the expectation is that they'll be subjected to a bit more due diligence because they are coming from a country that is in the FATF gray list. And even locally here for Kenyans, because banks will have to up their game when it comes to customer due diligence, and then that one of the issues that was raised in the mutual evaluation. Even for Kenyans opening bank accounts, including mobile money accounts, it's likely that they'll be subjected to more scrutiny. They'll be required to provide more information. That checklist that you find at the bank is likely to become longer in the coming weeks, in the coming months. And the same case applies for international transactions especially. Yeah, so that's a real risk, and it's because of that elevated risk that being placed on the gray list puts on us as a country and the people trading out of Kenya. Probably my colleagues, something to add, John Katangaza.
I find it a bit strange because I have two PayPal accounts, and one is based in the EU and one is in Kenya. And the EU one never ever get blocked. But and they're the same transactions, and when I run it through the Kenyan one, often you find a bit of a red flag left. So very interesting. John, you had something to say?
No, and it's pretty much what Faith has said. And I guess one thing we maybe don't appreciate when we are seated in Kenya or in Africa is just how little people out there, especially in the West, know about Africa. There's always this conversation of where Africa is not a country. You'll hear people saying, I went to Africa. For an analyst, a risk analyst seated in some bank in the US or the UK or Germany, they probably know very little about Kenya or any other country for that matter. At least Kenya, given athletes, given Obama, at least you have a bit more known. But typically, they will not know much about the country. So what they will do is they'll Google and they look at their trusted sources and they see Kenya is pre-listed so that the alarm bells then go off. I would give the example of they are selling passports because they are well known. You can pretty much go to any country without requiring to apply for a visa. But for most African passports, for instance, you're almost taken as a suspect, have been issued, because those people that are looking at the passport or making those analyses, they are going with the information that they have. And unfortunately, a lot of the times, the information out there is bad news tends to sell more. So people tend to be nervous. And that's what the gray list tends to do, is to make people more nervous. So the effects of the listing then adds to the nervousness. But maybe also we shouldn't paint it like it's all doom and gloom. Even from the studies that have been done, the effects of gray listing, even by that IMF study that I mentioned, we're talking about reductions of around 7% in FDIs. So it's not like we are saying greenness will round to a halt, but there would be a bit of effect that would be perceived up. So some of these things are unfortunate, but I suppose we also don't do ourselves any favors when we have, say, a lot of corruption being reported or from like now the recently released Transparency International Corruption Perception Index, we rank so highly. So when people out there have this information that we are corrupt, and then they come and see there is no case that is going, people are not being convicted, then people lose faith in your systems. And when they do, then they need to implement enhanced due diligence on you. So then the majority of people who are law-abiding, doing very legitimate business, then suffer because of some of those few but high-profile criminals, when we call them that.
I think from one of the reports I read, it's that the issue has been around the number of prosecutions around corruption and financial crimes do not reflect the level of risk that the country has, as John has clearly said. I think we need to up those. There could be issues that are out of our control, but those that are within our control are some things that we should approach with such forcefulness and be able to rectify, to get out of those, listen out, and if they're to get into good rapport with the world in terms of how it's going. Captain Gaza, I'll come to you. There is a couple of questions that are coming, and one is about how LSK can be helpful here in terms of effectively helping us not just get off the FATF grey list, but also like to build robust AML CFT muscle, so to speak. So that's one. Secondly, is about the refugees coming from neighboring countries who reintegrated into Kenyan society and how that also maybe have facilitated an increase in financial crime. And then the third point is on crypto. There are questions around how crypto affects that. So maybe John will respond to that. So I'll start with Katangaza and then we'll go to John and Titus.
Thank you. On your first question, how can the LSK be facilitated to deliver this role? So that's actually the work that I'm currently doing with the Law Society of Kenya, is to assist with building that particular muscle. And I said before, the difficulty for them is that they don't actually already regulate in the way that the central bank has always regulated financial services, for example. So this was just an added thing to their list. LSK has not been really regulating beyond dealing with complaints about lawyers from the public or from each other, that sort of thing. So this is a completely new ball game. So people will be trained on compliance and setting and running a regulatory entity. And that's part of the project. We have a number of training things in motion at the moment. They actually need to recruit staff who can do that job, because there isn't anybody currently who has any experience in that area. So it's a lot to do in a very short time. And actually, funny enough, today is the elections for the Law Society of Kenya has its election. So there's a new council that will be coming in as of next week, I believe. And because so much relies on that organ of the organization, I'm hoping very much that the new council will take on board this as a very serious thing that they have to basically manage over the next 2 years. And unfortunately, none of the campaigning candidates even mentioned AML CFD in their campaigns. And I suspect that had to do with more fear of risking their votes, because this whole thing is seen as extremely unpopular by the profession. If they haven't really taken it seriously, they'll be in for a surprise when they come in first. But I do have to say that my dealings with the FRC have been extremely positive, and I found them very, very on top of their game. I think that they've had resource constraints in terms of being able to do as much as they will have to, but I believe that they've got good leadership and everyone incredibly on top of what's happening and just need to get the action together. So I'm feeling quite positive. It will take a bit of time, but hopefully we'll be up and running sooner rather than later. The FRC also has a role to play in building capacity. So they provide training, they provide assistance to all the regulators who they supervise, and the FRC ultimately is the regulator of last resort. So if it doesn't work out as quickly or as well as it should in terms of the legal sector, they can take that reporting function away. But the LSK would still have a lot to do, because it has to actually help the profession to be efficient and to put these structures in place in the firms themselves and in the individual lawyers who are running small one-person outfits or proprietors, because all those will need to have a compliance function regardless of how small they are. On the second question regarding refugees, I'm going to confess here that I was once a child refugee in Kenya, and that was not a pleasant experience in many ways, because refugees are always a perfect target. As I grew up and lived in many other places, I realized it wasn't personal, that refugees are always a target. I live in a country which spent a lot of time at the moment, the government that's regularly accusing refugees of everything and basically piling up whatever the problems of the country are on their doorsteps, as if they don't have enough trouble. So I feel slightly sensitive about that. However, I know it wasn't meant in that way. You are a country that is surrounded by countries in conflict, and big conflict actually have international arms to them. It's not like in the previous few years ago where the conflicts were within countries, civil wars that were contained but may have had massive humanitarian effect. So Kenya ends up finding itself in this position where, yes, there might be some people who are branding themselves as refugees or who are refugees, but are involved in efforts to either destabilize their home country or join the freedom fight for their home country, because as they say, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, right? But the fact is, is that the need for weapons, the need for food, or the need for whatever it is, will be much more live in a population like that who feel squeezed and unaccepted. And so there are risks, I'm sure, but it mustn't take away from understanding that many of those people are just people who've lost everything and have arrived needing help. So I would be wary of putting a lot of the concern on that particular population, even though there are definitely risks inherent in those groups of people. All the more reason to have proper processing facilities and people being processed and having ID and being known and registered as refugees in the country that they find themselves in.
Well, valid points. And John and Titus, could you address the issue to do with crypto? And then also, we are going to be winding up soon. If you have any questions, just send them in very quickly so that we can get started on the winding up. John and Titus?
Maybe Titus, you want to take
them? Okay, thanks, John. So the issue of crypto, it's becoming a very topical issue in AML circles. And because this is an emerging technology, which, as I had mentioned, is proving quite attractive to people seeking to launder funds. And I had mentioned some of these features, but I could mention again some of the things that make cryptocurrencies particularly attractive to people seeking to launder funds. Are things like anonymity and the fact that you can trade using pseudo. Obviously, someone who holds proceeds of a crime, they would benefit greatly from that because then they're able to launder without necessarily disclosing their identities. The element of them being cross-border is also quite attractive because you can move cryptocurrencies across the border quite easily because they're internet-based. Again, for people who are seeking to launder money cross-country, which happens in many cases, as John was mentioning, most of the funds that originate from Africa end in the Western, end as investments or in banks in the Western or the safe havens that are there. So that bit of being cross-border becomes quite attractive for them. The mutual evaluation, the evaluators pick that particular issue that as a country, we haven't really done anything around virtual currencies. And recommendation there was, we need to take that issue seriously and start to do it. And there are many places where we could borrow from in terms of how that space is being regulated. The first thing that we need to do and that was recommended is we need to have a regulatory framework around it, which has been lacking for some time now. In fact, I think the regulators in Kenya, the stance they had taken at some point is to issue a cautionary notice to the public not to deal with the virtual currencies. But if you look at it, really, people are still dealing in the virtual currencies. So the risk there of money laundering and terror financing, therefore, becomes then left out there and no one really is bothered about it. So what the mutual evaluators and FATF by extension was asking of us is that we need to regulate that space. We need to come up with regulations around that area. And there are many places where we can borrow from. Now, cryptocurrencies tend to operate, at least for many people who deal in cryptocurrencies, they do it through crypto exchanges. And that's one of the areas that has become quite effective in terms of regulating because the crypto exchanges, their institutions and their organizations, and they are known. So what most countries then are doing is to require them to have similar kind of checks and controls that the banks would have. So most of these crypto exchanges are being asked, when they're onboarding their customers, they need to pick KYC details, just like the way that would happen when you go into a bank. And they also need to employ some AML procedures before doing business with you or before dealing with you as a customer. So, but as a country, we are not there yet. But I know in the recent past, there had been some movement there, particularly the amendment last year did make a mention of that. And there's a conversation that is happening around how that sector can be regulated. And we believe if we're able to achieve that, we might not be able to fully control what happens within that particular space, but at least what is doable as a country, we need to be seen to be committed to doing it instead of just ignoring the problem.
I'll give you guys now a chance to maybe give us all the practical advice to individuals and businesses that are listening in terms of how to protect themselves from being engaging in financial crime and what to be look out for. So maybe Titus and John, because you also have the practical experience of being in Kenya, what kind of practical ways can individuals and businesses take to maybe protect themselves from some of these issues? Maybe we can start with John and then Titus.
Okay. I suppose for money laundering as an individual, really the way to protect yourself is to not launder money. But if you are a business, if you have a business, then the whole concept of KYC, knowing your customer. And knowing your customer is not just about asking for their ID. It is actually knowing what business they're in. So if you don't want to be caught up, and as I said, one of the recommendations is that the government needs to start investigating, prosecuting, and convicting, and hopefully getting convictions for people involved in money laundering. So if you're in a business, it behoves you to want to know the sources of funds for people who want to do business with you. So if, for instance, you are selling a piece of land, as an individual, you're not a reporting entity. So you don't have any obligations to report unless you are among the designated businesses. So if you're in real estate, if you're a lawyer, if you're an accountant, then you need to know that you have a responsibility to know who you're dealing with, where they are getting their money, and report that as suspicious transactions to the FRC. And as Titus has said, there'd be a lot of awareness building and capacity building that needs to happen so that people in those businesses know how to do that. More as an individual, I guess it's, you know, you just don't want to be involved. It's a crime to handle stolen property, for instance. As an individual, you really need to be on the alert so that if something looks suspicious, if something looks too good to be true, then you avoid it. It might not be money laundering. Might just be you're getting conned. You're a victim of the predicate offense. So as an individual, probably it's not so much about you are being part of money laundering as opposed to you being taken advantage of. And economic crimes, talking of fraud, corruption, tax evasion, they are quite prevalent. Cyber, like the M-Pesa types of frauds. So just being on the lookout, being on that, when it's too good, it probably is too good to be true, is probably what I would advise. But otherwise, as a country, I would hope that we will all work towards getting ourselves out of this list. As I mentioned, it's not a death sentence. It's not groom and doom. We want to be out of that list, but we also want to actually have an effective AML, CFT, CPF framework as a country so that we can actually fight economic crime because it costs us quite a bit as a country. I think that's all I would say for now.
Thank you. Titus and Tatangazo, any advice?
Yeah, maybe just a few points to what John has mentioned. I think for individuals, you are more likely to fall prey to predicate offenses that give rise to proceeds that are then laundered. Obviously, if you're not involved in laundering, you are. And maybe just to explain that a bit more, in every case of money laundering, they'll be where the origin of the money, where the origin of the illicit funds, the demand is. So be it fraud, be it the scams that John is talking about, be it drug trafficking. So as we think for the general public, the main thing is to stay informed at that particular level. And those are what we call the predicate offenses. So that then you don't become a victim, but obviously then don't involve yourself in money laundering and terror financing. So in some of the tips there really would be around being informed, which is what John has mentioned. There are many campaigns which are run by financial institutions, by the government. So it helps just to pay attention to that, to those, so that you can educate yourself and in the process you get to know how to protect yourself. Things like personal information, being very cautious about who you are sharing your personal information with, where you are putting your personal information, especially when it comes to online matters or activities, because that's another area where we see very many members of the public then falling prey to scammers and online criminals. We all have a responsibility. If you find something is suspicious or toward. I think there are various mechanisms, there are various channels that are there. I think it helps when the public is actively engaged by playing that role of reporting, because from there, then that information or that intelligence is picked up by the law enforcement agencies and it's acted upon. Or as a public, in as much as we are saying that there is cause to protect them, but there is also a responsibility there in terms of the public playing their role in this fight against financial activities, and detection and reporting of suspicious activities is one of the ways where the public can play a role.
I don't think I have much more to add. And I think obviously there's a difference. There's the question of whether you're, as an individual, what your responsibilities are versus your responsibilities of reporting an entity. If you're in a regulated profession, please be compliant. There's a difference there. But I think more widely, and this is something like a point I was making to my colleagues in Kenya, was that this is, and actually both Titus and John have said this is an all Kenya issue. It's not just for one group of people. It's something that people have to come together to understand that this is about the country and not just to get off a grey list. Somebody did say to me, can we get off the grey list and then just go back to usual or something like that? And I thought, no, you can't and you shouldn't want to do that. It's a good thing to move past this and actually improve those processes because it's good for the country. It's good for everybody. So I think that's an important point. And I think somebody, again, Titus and John said earlier, the need for a kind of public information campaign, because I really think that people need to understand what it means, not necessarily you know, being grey listed. But the reason why these things are happening, what it means in their individual lives, and actually the importance of kind of keeping an eye out if you find yourself in a position where there's something that you can do about it. So I think the public awareness thing is an important one in general. And that's why these kind of events like you're having here today are very useful, because a lot of people don't actually realize that. I was very impressed at a meeting I had with Safaricom last week, the amount of training they've done on AML CFT for all their agents, 400,000 agents across the country have all been trained on AML CFT, from somebody with a small little brick phone because of M-Pesa, obviously, right through to somebody who's running a bigger entity. And they've done it using interesting and engaging means to reach people at whatever level they are. I think those kind of examples are absolutely critical to be rolled out in different ways and to different people. I think that's what I would say. Thank you very much.
I don't see any questions coming in, but I want to recognize that the Counterterrorism Policing Kenya Authority is tuning in through the official handle. So that's very, very nice to note. So as we close up, so perhaps I can give each of you a chance to tell us your closing thought and maybe anything else that you may have missed. And then one more thing is to let people know where they can find you if they need more information. I think PwC have a briefing out on the implications of FATF grey listing on Kenya. So I think you should check it out. I think it should be available on their website. So maybe Titus, and then John, and then Katangaza. In that order, you can start by giving us your closing thoughts and where people can find you. Titus, John, and then Katangaza.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mukai. And thanks also to the audience for being with us for the last 1.5 hours or thereabouts. And for you, Mukai, for organizing this discussion. I think it's quite important and very timely. And we need to have many more of these as we move into this very challenging phase that we've got, that as a country we find ourselves. In terms of how we move forward, I think it's to echo what Katangaza said. I think beyond anything, this is quite important for us as a country, not just to exit the listing, but generally to ensure that as a country, we are managing and combating financial crimes, and we are not victims, or we are not introducing unnecessary risk into the global financial systems. It's important for us all to appreciate, and also the need for more education in the space around what are the real impacts of some of these crimes that we speak about. Because if you think about terrorism financing as an example, as a country in the last 15, 20 years, we bore the brunt in a very severe manner. The number of terror attacks we've had in this country, they are quite many, leading to loss of life and many other similar consequences. So it's important that we bring this conversation to that level, and we make it under that this is not being done for the sake of exiting the grey list, but actually what FATF is seeking to do is to ensure that as a country, then we are not falling victims to some of these consequences that I speak about, of these crimes, money laundering, terror financing, and then underlying predicate offenses. Then as a country, as we move forward, is to work together, each of us to play their role, because I believe each of us has a role to play in whatever capacity holds towards ensuring that the areas and the deficiencies that are being pointed out by FATF are adequately addressed, and we are out the credit, and we are sustainably managing the risk of money laundering and terror financing going into the future. In terms of where to find us, we are based Westlands Delta Corner, PwC. We are there many channels through which you can reach us on. You can walk to our offices physically. We also have a website, and we have a dedicated section on the PwC website. It deals with matters, financial crimes, and generally forensics, which is a practice where John and I sit, which houses their financial crimes unit. When you go there, you'll be able to find a lot of material that we've put there on this particular topic and other relevant topics for all of us. So that's one of the channels to which we can reach us. We do organize events of this nature as well from time to time, and we are planning to have a series of them in the coming weeks. So when you get a chance, please step in the name. Let's all work together in tackling this challenge. So that be it for my end. What to you, John?
For me, it is just to thank you, Mukaya, first and Mwango for organizing this. And for all of you that have joined, an honor for you to have stayed this long. Hopefully you found it to be useful, and we look forward to engage, because really this is our country, and I think we all must do our part. Otherwise, we will not have a country to hand over to future generations. So in terms of standing up and making your voice heard, just scrolling down, I can see people here who have quite a bit of voice. So we really need to keep the whole conversation around economic crime in the forefront, so that we as a country actually start to believe that we can actually change things and get to a point where people will do the right thing because it's the right thing, and not because we see a pig in a grey list. but because it will be to our benefit. So I think I'll end there and wish everybody a good night and thank you.
Thank you very much. I too want to add my thanks to Mokaya and Mwangu for inviting me today, the random foreigner. And it's been a pleasure speaking to you and to speak alongside John and Titus, who are miles ahead. And please go and look at their information because that will give you all the guidance. My work, as I said before, is not really in this area specifically. So I don't have any particular guidance that I can provide or in an ongoing way on AML-CFT. But for those of you who are in the legal sector, you may well see me or I'll be popping up around your lives perhaps a bit more than previously. And I'm really looking forward to that. It's a pleasure very much. We're all East Africans, so we have to help each other and make sure that we get this right. Thank you so much for the kind invitation.
Thank you so much, all of you. John, Titus, Katangaza, for joining us on these spaces. Very informative. My key takeaway is that I think we need to look beyond just the grey listing. I think the grey listing was a point in time where we need to maybe pay keener attention to issues to do with financial crimes. And I think we all pay the price when we don't ensure that we're in compliance. So I think that's my key takeaway. So I'd urge all of you, every place that you are at, to try and make noise, especially to do with the grey listing and to do with the financial crimes reporting in Kenya so that we can enhance and make it more robust. Thank you so much for joining us on the spaces today.